Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Evil is back in our public lexicon. Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, the Washington sniper, here is real evil, and there is pretend evil. Hollywood has shown us every face of wickedness, from Frankenstein to Hannibal Lecter.
Tell me, Will, did you enjoy it? Your first murder? Of course you did, and why shouldn't it feel good? It does to God. Why, only last week in Texas, he dropped a whole church roof on the heads of 34 of his worshippers, just as they were groveling for him. He wouldn't begrudge you one journalist.
The roof can fall on anybody.
But not on Molly and Josh, I take it. Not yet, anyway. First he kills the pet, then the family. Freddy was your pet.
How have the monsters of the screen conditioned our understanding of real monsters? What movies help you make sense of a world stalked by evil? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is On Point's movie maven, Garen Daly, a film reviewer and owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts. Welcome, Garen.
Hi, Jack.
We're also joined by Thomas Hibbs, a professor of philosophy at Boston College and author of Shows About Nothing, Nihilism in Popular Culture from The Exorcist to Seinfeld. Welcome, Thomas Hibbs.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we began with Hannibal Lecter. Professor, help us understand the fascination the public has with this figure. He's practically a franchise in Hollywood today. Should we be alarmed by this, or is this just the kind of entertainment America has always had?
I think we ought to be a little alarmed by the kind of performances Hopkins seems to be turning in after Silence of the Lambs, which was a brilliant performance. I think that Hannibal and the more recent one are sort of in decline. But I think that points to a deeper problem in the Tom Harris, who wrote the novels, Hopkins, Hannibal Lecter industry, which is that the Silence of the Lambs starts out as a very serious investigation of evil. The supposition of law enforcement in that film is behaviorist, that everybody's either fine or they're sick. They've suffered some kind of trauma that has made them evil. And Hannibal, in the book version, it's clearer than in the film. In the book version, he turns to Clarice Starling and says, "Can't you say what I am? You've got everybody in moral dignity pants. I'm evil." Mm-hmm. And it starts out with this serious suggestion, which I take it runs through the horror genre, that our modern attempts through science, law, medicine, to reduce evil to some psychosomatic disorder or some trauma, that's deeply wrong. I think the horror genre has a kind of insight, and it wants to take us into the reality and mystery of evil. Where Hannibal ends up, though, I mean, even by Silence of the Lambs at the end, he's almost a comic figure. He's having an old friend for dinner. And he seems more inclined in the later films to kind of drop off one-liners while he disembowels artists in the film Hannibal. And then in the more recent one, in Red Dragon, I think it's more of the same. That's actually a prequel, but I think we get more of the same, and we get not as much of a serious investigation of evil as Silence of the Lambs promised.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that the insight of these films, or at least the original novel, is pretty much the one I was talking about at the beginning, that this is motiveless malignity, that the effort to account for it psychologically is mocked.
Yes.
As this is bootless. This
That's
is you're dealing with a kind of primal force here that can't be explained.
And in Hannibal, especially in Silence of the Lambs, this is clear, and in the later films too, that he turns evil into a kind of high art. There's that great scene in Silence of the Lambs where he's in that makeshift prison, and he steals the nightstick of one of the police guards there, mm-hmm. and brutally beats them, splattering blood. But he looks like a conductor as he's doing
yeah.
this, and Box Goldberg Variations is the musical accompaniment. Mm-hmm. So it's quite clearly a notion of evil as an art form. Mm-hmm. And of course, Hannibal doesn't eat everybody. He just eats the rude. We're told.
How about that, Karen?
Well, I think that that's all true, but I think we should back off a little bit and go back to what, you know, this is a movie, and the movies are designed to titillate us, to excite us, to get us in going to the theaters and plopping down our money. And you go back to the 20s, you've got horror films, evil films back in the 20s and in the 30s and the 40s, and you see a gradual changing and a shifting away from clear black and white evil to a more humanistic kind of evil. You're trying to get understand, like Hannibal Lecter is a smart guy who's gone astray. Mm-hmm. And if we go back to the basic Hollywood idiom of the Western, we find ourselves with a clear black and white. You know, the white hat, the black hat, the good sheriff, the bad, gang guy, the bank robber. And in a film that I simply adore, that we were talking about a little earlier, Sam Peckinpah's Ride of the High Country, 1962, one of the last great Westerns. It's a story about two old guys going up to get the gold and bringing it back, and one's good and one's kind of bad. There's also a very young girl there who's getting her first taste of life.
My father says there's only right and wrong, good and evil, nothing in between. It isn't that simple, is it?
No, it isn't. It should be, but it isn't.
What's going to happen to him?
A boy? I'll testify for him. They shouldn't be too hard.
Will you testify for Mr. Westrum?
No, I won't.
Why?
Because he was my friend.
There is Joel McRae and Marriott Hartley.
In her first role.
In her first role, speaking in Sam Peckinpah's On the Ride the High Country. And there it is. There is good and there is evil. And she says, isn't that the way things should be? And he says, they should be that way, but they're not.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we can see in Hollywood as we have moved through the ages, that things are not so simple and not so clear. You know, it's a simple case of black and white. No, it is grayer and more diffuse.
Mm. Have you seen that evolution as well, from the kind of that Manichaean view to something a little more, I don't know, sophisticated?
Sure, although I do think that if you go back to 40s film noir, you can find a lot of films, and we'll get to at least one of them perhaps later, that start out with what appear to be clear divisions between good and evil and end up pushing both sides toward the middle in some sense. And so there's a great deal of complexity there. I think that the real turn that I see, say, in the last 20 years, and especially in the last 15 and then with Silence of the Lambs, is not so much a graying, but an actual move towards seeing evil itself as the only thing that's attractive. In the first Silence of the Lambs film, the first Hannibal Lecter film, you see Clarice Starling, who's wants to save the lambs, the innocent. Well, in the Hannibal film, she's no longer really interested in that at all, and there's no one to really admire who's interested in goodness at all. So it shifts toward from the idea that goodness is victorious way back when mm-hmm. to evil is victorious. Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't punish the villain. I mean, Hannibal is left standing.
Yeah, you know, there's something else about Hannibal Lecter that I come back to. He is the new evil scientist. You know, he's the really smart guy. He's very, you know, he's got all these things going on. But the evil scientist has always been around. You know, in Dr. Caligari, you had the evil scientist. In Metropolis, you had the evil scientist. You know, and even in Frankenstein, you have the evil scientist who is playing God. And there seems to be this anti-intelligent thing going on here, where if you get too smart and you start playing with too many different things and you are playing God, you're going to get punished on a moral level in the film.
I have discovered the great ray that first brought life into the world.
Oh, and your proof?
Tonight you shall have your proof. But first I experimented only with dead animals, and then a human heart, which I kept beating for 3 weeks. But now I am going to turn that ray on that body and endow it with life.
And you really believe that you can bring life to the dead?
That body is not dead. It has never lived. I created it. I made it with my own hands from the bodies I took from graves, from the gallows, anywhere. Go and see for yourself.
That is a scene from the 1931 movie Frankenstein. And there, Garen Daly, you get the good intentions gone awry.
Yes.
That you don't have to intend evil to produce it. You can sometimes intend, he intends, a sort of benefaction to humanity.
Yeah, he's trying to do something good, but he gets lost. He loses his moral compass, and it's going to be the people who are going to rebel against what he does to try and get that moral compass back in line.
So when men try to play God, they produce the kind of unintended consequences that can sort of mock any good intention they might have.
Well, sure, and you could trace this all the way back to Mary Shelley's novel of Frankenstein. That there's a clear reference to Enlightenment science, the idea that human beings can control and have power over life itself, mm-hmm. and a warning that what you create can turn against you. And these are very timely with our debates about stem cells and about mm-hmm. cloning and so mm-hmm. forth. Mm-hmm. It seems to me we're really asking questions there that the origins of the horror genre are intended to help us think about.
That science can go too far, and that the professions of neutrality and even redemption, secular redemption offered by science, need to be regarded with great skepticism.
Yes.
That these great powers come with conditions often. The atom, for example.
Well, you know, the other thing about this is that when you're talking about the evil scientist concept, we're talking about someone who's using pure technology, pure knowledge, that very Western concept that we're always learning something, we're always building mm. upon something. But in the back of that is that there is no religious background. There's no moral background. You know, when he builds Frankenstein, he's not thinking about what the consequences are or what can stem cell research. We don't really see a break away from films of that nature until we see William Friedkin playing with The Exorcist and bringing religion mm. into the concept of the real evil that can be there. And, of course, it has to be a Catholic evil. It can't be a Baptist evil or a congregational evil. It has to be a Catholic evil. And it is so scary mm. because it is so unknown to us. And that when we see this film, we get sucked up into the logic of it. Almost Stephen Dedalus said the Catholic religion is almost a logical absurdity. And you see that absurdity coming through in The Exorcist, especially when Max von Sydow and the Karras priest are ready to go in and do battle with Satan.
We may ask what is relevant, but anything beyond that is dangerous.
He's a liar. The demon is a liar.
He will like to confuse us. But he will also mix lies with the truth to attack us. The attack is psychological, Damien. And powerful. So don't listen. Remember that. Do not listen.
Max von Sydow from The Exorcist. Thomas Hibbs. Is this about a movie about possession by some supernatural force, another kind of evil, rather than something intrinsic to humans, something sort of adventitious, coming from another world?
It sure is, although the film is very subtle and so well done, especially if you look back on it compared to contemporary horror films. It's also about the way human weakness, human vices can leave openings for this diabolical evil mm. to enter. And it does set up, I mean, to go back to the mad scientist and the issue of modern, I mean, the opening of that starts in Nineveh, and then you're shifting back to Georgetown in D.C., and it goes back and forth for a while, the modern and the ancient, the primitive and the scientific, and they attempt to use all these medical means to uproot this evil and don't succeed.
And there your evil is in Satan, and it can trigger something in human beings, but it's outside. And the whole notion of exorcism, does that imply a kind of innocence that people can cast out their evil, have it exorcised? It isn't in them, it's in this.
Well, it's not a pure innocence to start out with or a pure innocence after mm-hmm. before or after possession, because there are vices around before and mm-hmm. there are things afterward that we still have to worry about. So I think the film does a remarkable job of balancing the notion of demonic or diabolical evil with human virtue and vice. And human virtue, and especially self-sacrificing love, seem to be the ultimate counter to the demon.
You love to get rid of the devil, huh?
Yeah.
That's your answer.
Well, there's something that I wanted to touch upon. We've been talking about evil, and its counterpart is good. And I don't think that we can really have a thorough understanding of it until we understand that you can only have good and evil in an ordered universe. In a chaotic universe, there's no such thing as good and evil. So you have to have a construction around it, and that's what The Exorcist really shows. And one quick point about it being scary, it happens to a straight-ahead, middle-class family that this demonic thing comes down on.
Terrifying. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about evil in the movies.
I've got a wife and three kids. I don't want him on the streets any more than you do.
Well, he won't be out there long.
What is that supposed to mean?
I mean, sooner or later he's going to stub his toe and then I'll be right there.
This office won't stand for any harassment.
You know, you're crazy if you think you've heard the last of this guy. He's going to kill again.
How do you know?
Because he likes it.
Clint Eastwood in Dirty Harry. We're talking about evil in the movies, and we're asking, how have the movies helped you understand the world we're in, or have they rather sort of blinded you to the complicated nature of things? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael is on the line. Hello, Michael.
Hi. I've long been concerned about the extent to which our good guys act really badly. That often the only way we can tell they're good is because there's some impetus given at the beginning, which is often forgotten along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And while they're doing what they do, they knock people around. Mm-hmm. You know, they cause big explosions. They violate every rule of the department. And it's okay because they're the good guys. To sort of riff off what Mr. Natsios is saying at the end of Last Hour, it's sort of a twisted Calvinist view of the universe in which there is the elect and the preterite, and what the elect do doesn't change their status as the elect.
That's a very acute point. Thomas Hibbs, we had David Kennedy, the Stanford historian, on our show recently, and he was saying he noticed a pattern in the American character that we insist on a degree of safety and security that other nations don't. We almost want absolute invincibility. And in pursuit of making ourselves safe against evils, we do the most terrible things. So our caller is kind of making a similitude between the United States, or I am, between the United States with its professions of innocence and the way it lays about it when provoked, and characters in the movies, our heroes who are given permission to just tear up the landscape.
I think that's right. I mean, the Dirty Harry clip that ran right before the caller is not quite in that vein, but he is a kind of hero on the edges of the system whom we cheer for, in part because in these films the system is so corrupt that it can't protect us. And Dirty Harry seems to have at least some sense of justice, however corrupted and tainted that is, by his own willingness to go outside the law. It strikes me that the Dirty Harry character doesn't quite do what the caller suggesting, because there are places where there's a later film in that series where there are a group of cops who are simply going outside the law completely to execute a series of killers. And when Harry runs into them at one point, they say, well, we expected you to be with us. And so he's got to think about whether he should resist that or he should go ahead with it. And there he resists it. He realizes there are limits, no matter how corrupt the system is. And so there's a kind of affirmation there of some degree of restraint. Mm-hmm. But I think that's right. I mean, I think you could say that certain Bruce Willis films, Schwarzenegger films, fit this model where violence seems to be celebrated so long as there's a pretty good guy whom we can cheer for and who can drop really good one-liners along the way.
Yes.
And then it's justified.
Yeah.
Speaking of one-liners, we should make a quick note here that Dean Reiser, the guy that gave Dirty Harry those good one-liners, just recently died, just a little homage
make
to him.
Make my day, or that doesn't make my day. But.
However, you know, one of the things about Dirty Harry is that he gives us a kind of a compass when society seems to be drifting away from what's right and wrong, what's good and evil. And I think one of the concepts that good and evil gives us, it gives us a place in our society where we know who we are and what is expected of us. And in the 70s, when Dirty Harry came out, we were drifting. The criminals seemed to have more rights than we did. Mm-hmm. And and that's what Dirty Harry is all about, even though he was on the outside. And that's, you know, that kind of concept is picked up later on in Tarantino. He picks this up and starts saying, I'm going to be the moral compass. And in Pulp Fiction, he gives Samuel L. Jackson the fire and brimstone of being a religious person and justifying his evil deeds of murdering people with religious scripture.
You read the Bible, Grip?
Yes.
Well, there's this passage I got memorized.
Sort of fits this occasion.
Ezekiel 25:17. The path of the righteous man is beset on all sides by the inequities of the selfish and the tyranny of evil men. Blessed is he who in the name of charity and goodwill shepherds the weak through the valley of darkness, for he is truly his brother's keeper and the finder of lost children. And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brothers. And you will know my name is the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon thee.
Samuel L. Jackson in Pulp Fiction. Thomas Hibbs, just historically, probably more violence, more death has been meted out in the name of God, as we just saw on September 11th, than any other cause one can imagine. And here we have it in the movies.
Yeah, although the Samuel Jackson character there is, he's not taken that seriously at that point. I mean, as he says later, he actually undergoes a sort of odd kind of conversion, because right after that scene where he blows away this kid, some other kid pops out of a closet and shoots at him point blank and misses. And he has an extended debate with his partner, John Travolta, about whether that was a miracle or whether, as Travolta says, this stuff just happens. And later he says, this is just some nasty stuff I like to say to people before blowing them away, the Ezekiel thing. The Pulp Fiction, I mean, right before that hit, you have them joking about McDonald's burgers being called Royale with cheese in Europe, about whether it's worse to give a foot massage or to have oral sex with your boss's girlfriend. There's this strange and unsettling mixture of comedy and serious violence in these films. And the Ezekiel thing is just one more mix in there, one more odd thing that Tarantino throws in to sort of disturb us further, I think.
And this movie, of course, was attacked by many critics, by Roger Shattuck in the Atlantic Monthly, as itself almost an instrument of evil for its nihilism and so on. Let's take a call from Larry in Madison, Wisconsin. Hello.
I'm concerned about the personification of the devil, especially how it nowadays, some people may actually take it seriously. We have a history in Western civilization, particularly fed in the later Middle Ages, in which the devil was seen as a reality, but who had real-life agents in people's minds on Earth. It led to, as a result of that, and this carried through not only in the Middle Ages, but carried through in various ways, particularly during World War II, to enormous death, to enormous evil, evil which transcends anything we've seen in the movies or in people's minds.
So there's just tremendous evil in saying to someone else, so they can be, you are evil.
Yes, and I think, well, especially if I mean, there are people who commit evil acts, mm-hmm. but it's when an ideology or a faith or an idea
right.
grips hold of people, firmly believing in a real devil that's behind everything, and then locating falsely real-life agents of that presumed devil.
Yeah, thank you. Thomas Hibbs.
Yeah, I think this is a real worry. There's a terrific book by Andrew Del Banco, who's a great cultural critic, called The Death of Satan. He's very concerned about the decline of our language of evil, that we seem to have our moral imagination and vocabulary kind of atrophied over the years. But he suggests in the end that what we need is actually a notion of it's also a very medieval notion, dates back to Augustine, evil as non-being, as a kind of lack, as an absence, a vacuum. Mm-hmm. Because if you go that way, rather than the Manichaean or dualist view, if you go with evil as an absence, you avoid demonizing the other, because there can be no thing that exists that is purely evil. Mm-hmm. And I think the caller and Delbanco are sort of making a similar point here, that Delbanco really thinks we're in a crisis with respect to evil, that we don't know how to talk about it. We don't have good images and stories, but he doesn't want to move toward a kind of Manichaean view. Mm-hmm. He wants to adopt this view as evil as a lack in the midst of goodness, as a defect. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me, politically, Delbanco wants to make the point that this helps you to avoid demonizing the other.
Right.
You know, one of the things that I've been mulling over ever since 9/11 and since I've been hearing a lot about evil coming from Washington and evil in the speeches is, you know, why all of a sudden is evil coming into the forefront of our language right now? Why is it that we need to talk about evil? Before, we used to talk about illnesses, or they were sick, or they were twisted, they were demented. Now it's evil. We seem to be making it black and white, and we're struggling with some sort of duality there. And I have to say, I'm a little confused by it. And I'm wondering whether or not, you know, Thomas, if you could help me with that one.
Well, I mean, I think there are obvious reasons after September 11th that evil came back in and should come back in, it seems to me. But our language hasn't developed much beyond that in the past year, for thinking about these things. And I think that's the place to start, that certain acts were evil. And they can't be described, it seems to me, wanting to slaughter as many possible innocent people as you can. Is certainly evil, if anything is. But we got to go beyond that. And I think culturally, we don't really have the vocabulary, the narratives. We're at a particularly weak point at this time. And Hollywood is not in the best position to help us here. At least it hasn't been.
To give us a more complicated code, to be able to say this action is evil, but it had all sorts of background and history and so on.
Right. Or even a more detailed account in terms of detailed accounts of vices or virtues.
Yeah.
If you've just got a blanket identification of evil, that might be you might be sleeping or not alive if you couldn't start with that. But if you don't get beyond that, it's not very helpful.
Let's take a call from Vanessa from Newton, Massachusetts. Hello, Vanessa.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
This is a fabulous conversation. I couldn't help but call.
Great.
I just wanted to make a couple of points. One is, we're talking about blurring the lines of good and evil. I'd say that Dirty Harry, based upon a friend's observation from many years ago, is like the second coming of Beowulf, which is pre-medieval. It's a matter of perspective, who is actually bad. And when John Gardner spins the yard, suddenly you're very sympathetic toward Grendel, as you are toward Scorpio. Then the second point I just wanted to make is, we're starting to evolve in horror where we start to stop asking if this is truly evil. Alien started it, I think, by making us reflect on the fact that there are other life forms that might have a different agenda. Mm. And another form of survival. And the most recent, Jeepers Creepers, I think has taken it to the next level. There's no explanation. Stuff just happened.
Mm. Horror movies and their this sympathy with the devil, she notices, when you tell the tale a different way. You've been getting at some of this too, Thomas. It's
interesting she mentioned Jeepers Creepers, which is a very effective little horror film. And it deals with a brother and a sister meeting this unknown character out in the middle of nowhere. It deals with the duality of a male-female. And it reminds me of Hitchcock. And I have to say that I think that we can go back to Hitchcock and he can help us with some of these questions. And a lesser-known Hitchcock that I really adore is Shadow of a Doubt, in which there are two Charlies, a male Charlie and a female Charlie, an older Charlie, an uncle, and the niece Charlie, played by Teresa Wright. And it's all about the older Charlie being the merry widow murderer and the younger Charlie being this extremely innocent young girl. And when she finds out that he is a killer and a murderer, the confrontation between them gets a little on the edgy side.
What do you know, really? You're just an ordinary little girl living in an ordinary little town. You wake up every morning of your life and you know perfectly well that there's nothing in the world to trouble you. You go through your ordinary little day, and at night you sleep your untroubled, ordinary little sleep filled with peaceful, stupid dreams. and I brought you nightmares. Or did I, or was it a silly, inexpert little lie? You live in a dream. You're a sleepwalker, blind. How do you know what the world is like? Do you know the world is a foul sty? Do you know if you ripped the fronts off houses, you'd find swine? The world's a hell. What does it matter what happens in it? Wake up, Charlie. Use your wits. Learn something.
Joseph Cotten talking to a silent Teresa Wright in Alfred Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt, filmed memorably in Santa Rosa, California. Now there, Thomas Hibbs, we get the, I would almost call it Nietzschean kind of evil. And you see it most clearly, really, in a scene in The Third Man, where you have Orson Welles and Joseph Cotten, now Joseph Cotten as the good guy, on a Ferris wheel above Vienna. And he stops the Ferris wheel and says, "See those people down there," pointing to the crowd. "They're just ants. They're just living their little life. They're just so many ants." There's this kind of Nietzschean exaltation. I am above this sort of thing.
A rope, too, which, of course, has the explicit teacher.
The Loeb-Leopold murders, yeah.
Right, yeah, with Jimmy Stewart as the professor. It's kind of hard to believe him as the professor teaching Nietzsche to his students, but he's ill-fit for that part, I think. But that notion runs through... It runs through a number of Hitchcock films in a much more subtle way than it does, say, in the early 90s Scorsese Cape Fear thing, where we've got a sort of Nietzsche out of control in De Niro's Katie. But Hitchcock's terrific at the evil right beneath the ordinary.
Mm.
And also this the sense of the duality, that they're both named Charlie. They have many similarities in personality. And she comes to sense some of the same capacities in herself that she senses in what turns out to be the Merry Widow murderer. So this notion that the lines are not as clear, we find all the way back there in Hitchcock, the line between good and evil. And yet we don't quite go over into the pure Nietzschean universe in Hitchcock. There's still some sense that there's a part of Charlie, at least the young Charlie, that holds on to something other than what her uncle has become.
Mm. And, of course, too, so often in these movies, as Vanessa was saying, there's as with Milton's Satan, the devil, the wicked character is the interesting one.
Right, and Hitchcock films all sorts of things, but just the way he sets it up, the opening of Psycho with Marion Crane, we want her to get away.
Yeah.
You know, he films so many of these things where we are put in a position as viewer where we have to identify with the bad guy, at least momentarily.
We're talking about evil in the movies at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Frank is calling from Upton, Massachusetts. Hello.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I wanted to throw into the mix the movie 12 Monkeys by Terry Gilliam.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it has some particular resonance today. Evil is sort of a manifestation of various ideas, whether it's the officials in the psych ward, the governmental officials, street thugs, and they're all following their own sort of Ahab-like monomaniacal courses, and then evil blossoms out of that by excluding other people's concerns and needs, if you will. And you have the protagonist, to continue a Moby Dick parallel, sort of as an Ishmael, a reluctant hero, just obedient, going along with the course that he's supposed to follow in becoming a hero.
In this case, it's Bruce Willis as Ahab. Yeah, we're going to get back 12 Monkeys, an old Chinese parable, I believe, originally. We're talking about evil in the movies, and we're asking, how have the movies affected your moral imagination? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about evil in the movies.
Why do you fear the past? You are a Sealdor's heir, not a Sealdor himself. You are not bound to his fate.
The same blood flows in my veins. The same weakness.
Your time will come. You will face the same evil and you will defeat it.
Lord of the Rings, that's Liv Tyler and...
Viggo Mortensen.
Viggo Mortensen. Now, what's the resonance there of evil? What's the...
Well, you know, versus this is Lord of the Rings. It was written in the 1950s, became a pop culture hit in the 60s for kids like me who are reading it in college, and now it's been turned into probably one of the great films of all time, where Peter Jackson has done an incredible job of recreating Middle Earth, and in that recreation he creates a very clearly defined black and white world of good and evil. Liv Tyler is an elven woman. She's good. Viggo Mortensen is a man who is worried that when he faces evil, he will not be able to live up to the challenge of it because his father failed to live up to the challenge and brought evil back into the Middle Earth. And it's a struggle between getting rid of a ring that symbolizes all that is evil to bring happiness to everybody. And I think it's really interesting that at the turn of the century, we are glomming onto this very clear distinction between good and evil, making it the most popular film of the year.
Mm. And, of course, Thomas Hibbs, just in time for the sort of great drama of good and evil our government is presenting to us today.
Well, yeah, I think, though, that this... There is a clear distinction between what's good and what's evil here, but it also contains that Augustinian notion of evil as a kind of non-being. I mean, take Gollum, the wonderful character who both hates and loves the ring as he hates and loves himself. But at one point, Gandalf says of him that he has barely any life left because the evil has so consumed him. He has, I think Gandalf says in the book, only a nasty, furtive remembering and eating. That's all he's got left. And so there's this sense of evil as eating away at those who give in to it. And notice, too, that the goal here is not to fight the enemy and destroy it, but to destroy something that is too powerful for human beings to control, the ring. Too powerful for all finite creatures to control. And in fact, no one would go to war at all if they could simply destroy the ring. So there's a notion there of attempting to avoid battle at all costs if one could simply remove the mechanism whereby bad guys could control everything.
Ah, that would be rewrite the whole moral universe.
That's right.
Anne is calling from Harwich, Massachusetts. Welcome. Thank you for calling.
Hi. It's really nice to be on the show. I never would have thought of calling. I was so excited about the show, and then I started feeling, I started getting a very strong visceral reaction, like this is not the time to be talking so enthusiastically about these Hollywood characters. The topic could have, I think, been handled in a very different way. If we were not reinforcing all these stereotypes and getting excited about them, I mean that's
well. This is provocative, but what stereotypes are we reinforcing?
Well, these very evil people. Mm-hmm. That it's almost like that there's just this tone. I mean, I love this show and I listen to it every day, and I've never called, but I felt sick to my stomach because. Here we are. We're struggling to understand what's going on in the real world.
Yes,
and we're trying not to be fascinated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're trying to grasp an incredibly difficult. I mean, this is a spiritual challenge for everybody, and to hear. The Hollywood part talked about so much with, you know, oh, there's this movie and
right,
that
right,
movie.
Right, right, right.
It diminishes the real questions. And I think we could, there's an opportunity for people to weigh in with a much more nuanced kinds of insights and maybe questions. And also express confusion, you know, like try to understand this, these people we're talking about going to war with. That's tough, and
I feel
like we're minimizing it.
Right, we're not paying enough attention to how much more complicated things are in the real world, and even the real moral world, than they are in the movies. Of course, we're trying to challenge that too. We're trying to say, are the movies adequate or aren't they adequate? What about that, Thomas Hibbs? Just in general. They're an art form. But are they an effective criticism of life? Do they at their best arm us even to make sense of a world like this?
Well, at their best, they give us a vocabulary. They give us stories, things that we can draw upon. I mean, I think one of the great dangers, and Delbanco, whom I mentioned earlier, stresses this, the great dangers for our youth is a kind of atrophying of the moral imagination, so that they get a large dose of very sensationalistic, heavily violent sorts of stuff. And it's not so much that they're all going to go out and become snipers or Columbine killers. That's not the real danger, thank God, for most of our kids. The real danger is that they're existing in a kind of vacuum where they don't have stories, complex stories, not stories that have simple divisions between these people are good and those people are bad, but where the struggle in the human soul for goodness and the struggle to figure out what goodness is presented as noble. And I think a film like Lord of the Rings does that.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about another movie that does that. Anne, thank you very much for that call. And Frank, thank you for your earlier call. Garen?
Well, I think that, you know, Anne has a very good point, and I think that Lord of the Rings does approach it, that balanced act that we want to do. But To Kill a Mockingbird is a film that I come back to time and time again, and it's something I seem to rediscover every two or three years. And in that film, there's so much that is good in that film, and there's so much in the stories that Harper Lee told and that Horton Foote wrote about and put on the screenplay and that Gregory Peck ends up putting on the screen. And one of them is someone of a normal, everyday nature putting up the good fight against the evil. And it's they are good and they are fighting evil. And explaining that to a child who needs to be taught about good and evil is one of the real strengths of the movie.
I'm simply defending a Negro, Tom Robinson. Scout, there are some things that you're not old enough to understand just yet. There's been some high talk around town to the effect that I shouldn't do much about defending this man.
If you shouldn't be defending him, then why are you doing it?
For a number of reasons. The main one is that if I didn't, I couldn't hold my head up in town. I couldn't even tell you or Jim not to do something again. You're going to hear some ugly talk about this in school. But I want you to promise me one thing. That you won't get into fights over it. No matter what they say to you.
No world with Atticus Finch in it can be all bad, Thomas.
Well, that's right. I mean, the film is marvelous in the way it captures the sort of wide-eyed wonder of children as they're trying to sort out the adult world. I mean, think about the character Boo Radley, whom they think is evil and ends up being the great hero, saving the kids at the end. And this is a great film that mixes kind of liberal principles about equality. It's a kind of anti-racism film, but it's tinged with this sort of Southern stoicism that Atticus fails in this attempt to save Tom Robinson. It's all a miserable failure. And yet his virtues seem to shine through, the virtues of the common man, seem to shine through even more in their failure than they would in his success.
A kind of Lincoln-esque character and performance, too. Yeah, that is a movie that makes you want to stand up and right wrongs.
And again, like I said when I started off talking about this film, you can go back to this film and watch it again and again. And that really, to me, is what a classic film is all about, because you're still taking something from it. It's still teaching you something. It's still giving you hope that there is something besides evil out there, and that if you do fight the good fight, you may not win them all, but you are going to go through life with dignity, and you're going to have a moral compass that guides you on the way.
Yes, and it just so happens to be coextensive there with American liberalism, one of the rare films where suddenly the liberal moral universe, which is often criticized as relativistic and having no absolutes, is shown as a source of strength and moral vigor.
No, there's no question about that, and I think, you know, much of the nihilistic strain in the last 30 years in Hollywood is not so much an attack as, like, people might, like Michael Medved, think upon neoconservatives. It's attack upon the foundations of liberalism.
Well, that's a provocative thought. We're return to again with you, Thomas Hibbs. Thank you very much. Thomas Hibbs, he's a professor of philosophy at Boston College and author of Shows About Nothing, Nihilism in Popular Culture, From the Exorcist to Seinfeld. And Garen Daly, thank you. Garen Daly is the owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and our movie maven. Continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, Al Franken on the delicate art of political humor. This is On Point. Humor can be a double-edged sword for politicians. It can charm a crowd and disarm a critic, but humor can also make a leader appear insensitive or cruel. Abraham Lincoln was criticized for his love of humorous anecdotes in the midst of the Civil War. Last night at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston, comedian Al Franken and CNN analyst Jeff Greenfield discussed the delicate art of political humor. Here is an excerpt from that discussion, beginning with the liberal Franken responding to the question of whether any conservative politicians have a sense of humor.
Bob Dole had what I consider ironic self-distance, which is a horrible thing for a politician to have. There was always sort of was viewing himself from outside, I felt, and looking at the irony of the process. And someone who didn't do that was Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was always what he was saying, he believed. And at all times, you know, he was completely consonant with what he was saying. Bob Dole I once saw at a pro conference, and they hated him.
This is a Ross Perot people.
Ross Perot conference in 95, and it was the year before he became the nominee. And Bob Dole stood for everything the Perot people hated, and he knew they hated him. And he had a speech, and at one point he says, "Now, Bob Dole isn't perfect." And this is in the speech, and I'm reading along the speech, but he injects because he just didn't like them. He just went, "Bob Dole isn't perfect. Maybe you people are." And I just went, God bless him, you know. And he didn't use it to great effect for his own good, but he was really very funny. I remember something he did in one of the debates where Lehrer cut him off, but didn't really cut him off. So it was like, "And to buy more food, and then Lehrer went, "Sir, your time is up." But he covered up food, and then he goes, "So you can complete your thought." And he just went, "Food." Do you remember that moment? It was really, really funny. So he's funny, and Reagan was very funny. Reagan was very funny. As I said, when he got shot, it was like not one joke. He was like eight jokes.
"Yeah, well, I hope the surgeons are Republicans. Tell mommy I forgot to duck."
And it was just like boom, 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 boom. And it was
I think that point people have gotten. But there was one line he did in his 88 speech at the convention in New Orleans. He was bidding farewell, and Clinton was in 92. Sorry, 92. Clinton was the nominee. He'd come back, and he said, "Now I see some people are talking about this fellow William Jefferson Clinton, and they're comparing him to Thomas Jefferson." And then reaching back to Lloyd Benson's famous evisceration of Dan Quayle, Reagan says, "Let me tell you something. I knew Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was a friend of mine. And Bill Clinton is no Thomas Jefferson."
Now, I wrote a riff on that whole thing for Gore, which was they used it the gridiron. And Gore said, "This is my plan for the first debate. I'm going to throw Bush. I'm going to say something negative about his father, at which point I'm sure he'll defend his father. And at that point, I'm going to say, I knew George Bush. George Bush was a friend of mine, and you, sir, are no George Bush," which I believe will hopelessly confuse Governor Bush. And so that was...
considering those debates, he should have taken it.
He should have done it.
Comedian Al Franken and CNN analyst Jeff Greenfield at a forum on political humor held last night at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarti, Eileen Amada, Kelly Jones, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Tim Skog, and Karen Schiffman. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.